This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. I like this. It's SZA with Kendrick Lamar and All the Stars. Black Panther soundtrack. It is 7:15 on CliffCentral.com. Hope you're having a good start to your day and your day's going nicely so far. And don't forget that tomorrow is like a mini Friday because Friday's a holiday. Are you excited?
All right.
Yes. Hey, more and more people are getting the Cliff Central unwired earphones and they love them. One happy customer said great quality earphones for the related price. Pouch makes it easy to carry them around when you're not using them and the pods sit comfortably in ear. I didn't write that. Someone else did. Someone else commented, these are well thought through, perfect device, quality sound, easy to use, love it. You can purchase a pair now and write your own review. We'd like to hear from you. The Cliff Central unwired earphones connect to any smartphone, laptop, or tablet for listening to podcasts, music, videos, and even phone calls. With over 10 hours of battery life, built-in microphone, 3-button controller, and an ergonomic design so it doesn't fall out of your ears when you're exercising, plus brilliant sound and build quality, the Cliff Central unwired earphones are the perfect match to your favorite podcasts. You can get them on takealot.com exclusively for just 550 Rand. At Takealot, you can also shop online on your phone or on the app anytime, anywhere with cash on delivery payment options and free delivery on your first order. Ben likes ordering online. I like ordering online. You should try it. It's always nice when you get that package at work the next day. Takealot.com. Shop anything you can imagine at everyday low prices.
Also, bypassing people is a big salient feature of online shopping.
Isn't it great? Mm. Yes. All right. So there was an interesting article written by Clem Sunter, who really is, you know, one of those people who tends to pick up on trends before they become trends. And he was saying that he's watched how teachers and students interact these days. And really what the teachers do is they just become facilitators because the kids at school who are there to discuss and debate what the future might hold have so much imagination, have so many ideas that all the teacher has to do is throw an idea at them and it turns into like a Nostradamus class of what could happen. And because young people are in the enviable or unenviable position, depending on your point of view, of not having terribly much to lose in South Africa, they have a lot to gain by imagining the kind of future they want. If you want to change, you have to be willing to sacrifice something that you've got going on now. If you're very entrenched in the current system, if you like the way things are operating at the moment because it works for you, why would you want change? So a lot of young people in South Africa, according to Clem Sunter, are able to think out of the box and do things differently because they don't have a lot to lose in the current system and they've got imagination and they've got this ability to envisage and to visualize the future that they want. I thought it was an interesting observation because we often, you know, knock millennials and we say things about, you know, young people not necessarily knowing how the real world works. But maybe these are the people who will save the world because they are going to live longer than the rest of us. You know, if you're in your teens or your 20s right now, the chances are that your average lifespan will be 100, maybe even 120 years. Yeah, Sia, you're going to live that long. Mm-hmm. People in their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s are not going to live that long. They're just not going to grow up in a world where the health conditions are conducive to that. And, of course, where food and medical knowledge and the information that we've gathered on how we operate as organisms, all of that stuff will be improved over the next couple of years exponentially to the point where life will be very difficult for people who were born 100 years ago to even understand. So it is an interesting observation, and I think you should take a look at the article if you want to know more.
It's a lot of pressure on their little shoulders, but the onus is on them to save the world, because how many times has history shown us how often the adults of that time fucked up the world?
Yes.
So the onus is on young people to save it.
And you've had like the people in the 60s and whatever, they were so like, we're going to free and liberate the world from the bullshit. Like, we are the flower, sex, drugs, and happiness people. And like, you know, 30 years later, those same dudes wearing suits, making decisions to produce more plastic straws, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. And just they become like, the institution.
But that book, Sapiens, was brilliant because it spoke about how in the next 50-odd years, if all goes according to expectations, you'll have this generation of people who are amortal, which is like immortal, but if you get hit by a truck, you still die.
Mm-hmm.
But like presuming nothing kills you, you won't die. And like the implications of that are mad.
Kind of like trees. Trees don't die unless you chop them down, essentially.
Pretty much like trees, yeah.
Damn.
And like also then like also like the, and it goes on for a long time. There's a lot to discuss around it if you were so inclined. But one of the interesting points was that like how paranoid would you be about your safety if the only thing that could kill you was like something has to kill you. You won't just die. You won't just grow old and die. Like you have to put yourself in danger.
Harm,
it needs danger. How paranoid would you be about danger if you plan to live forever? You could live forever. You were 250 years old and your oldest mate just got like lightninged. You wouldn't go outside.
Completely paranoid. Yeah. If you did go outside, you'd have to be inside of one of those protected bubble balls or something. I don't know.
What a gift. The opportunity to live forever.
But you're not a Highlander. It's not like you can't. You're not Wolverine. It's you'll survive anything.
You're not indestructible.
Exactly.
I mean, if you are, you know, run over by a truck, they're not going to be able to put the pieces together again.
No, you're shot in the head. It's over.
Yeah, but you won't get diseases. You won't grow old. You won't deteriorate. Those kinds of things will become a thing of the past.
Immortal.
And I wonder how this is going to affect the way people feel about an afterlife. You know, whether they're going to imagine that there is a need for that kind of thinking if you can live to 500 or 600 years old. Imagine that.
Well, yeah, why worry about the after when you can worry about the now?
It's uncertain, whereas now you can create more certainty. Afterlife is a bit of a bonus at the end.
Yeah.
And we're always talking about resources, right? The one thing that you can't make more of is time. And in this case, you could make more time. So suddenly we would be able to, you could spend 100 years specializing in something and become so super specialist that no human being that's ever lived would be as specialized as you in that particular field. And then for the next 100 years, you could do something completely different.
Yeah, see, that's probably the first argument for living longer, which I'm actually down for. Because I don't want to be that decrepit vessel because, you know, it looks horrible.
But you would be healthy.
But you can still do this and specialize in something.
No, I think it would be fascinating. So the one thing we talk about often is time. The other resource we talk about is money. And I read this story just yesterday about a woman in the U.S. who won $350 million in the lotto.
Yeah, a woman in New Hampshire. But she's taking legal action to protect her identity from being revealed.
Well,
because
now she's got money, she can get lawyers.
Because under New Hampshire law, a lottery winner's name, town, and prize money are public information. And she's saying, but hang on. I don't want people to know that I'm the person who won this money. And so the two of them, this woman and then the people from the lottery board, are basically fighting it out in court. She hasn't turned in her ticket yet, but she did show lottery officials a photocopy of the ticket. And as far as the lottery board are concerned, speaking through the executive director, Charlie McIntyre, he said, well, while we respect this player's decision, or rather desire to remain anonymous, state statutes and lottery rules clearly dictate protocol. And once you purchase
rules
that...
Rules is rules.
Once you purchase the ticket, you are essentially signing onto the contract.
This woman is my hero. You know why? She's the opposite of everyone else on Earth right now. She is not looking for attention. She wants the opposite. Do you remember yesterday we were talking about attention seeking and how odd this is? It's a sort of new human behavior and social media enables it and all the rest of it. This woman wants to keep her name private.
Sure, and I would as well if I won a shitload of money.
You would, right?
Yeah. Like a mega shitload. Like, you know, like that kind of money. But I'm not saying whether she's right or wrong to want to be anonymous. I'm saying the rules are the rules. If you buy the ticket and the ticket says,
all right,
if you get all the numbers, you get the money, and we'll tell everyone who
you are. Fair enough. But if you had the option, like she's not going to sue them.
I'd be anonymous, definitely.
You wouldn't want people to
know. Especially if it was lots of money. If you win a few hundred grand and you upgrade your house, that's a different story. But if you've won like tens or hundreds of millions,
she's in the hundreds of millions
bracket. I definitely don't
want
people to know.
Well,
okay, but now is this a security thing, or does she just not want people talking to her, like second cousins going, "Oh, I got a sore knee, I need an operation."
Yeah,
I'd say both are valid, hey.
Listen,
because if it comes down, like, again, I think all of us are quite similar here. We'd always want to be anonymous because we like to do our own thing. But for the most people, would
not
that's
Sia.
Why.
Sia would tell people.
Actually, Sia,
you would tell people that, if you won $500 million.
Oh, no, ma'am, no ham, no turkey, no salami.
Sia,
I don't want shit.
Sia, you would be parading around town in gold outfits. Yeah. You would be flying in your helicopter.
You would only travel by float.
But
what? What?
literally have Diana Ross as his praise singer.
No. Touch me in the morning.
Just like, I'm coming out.
So like, you know when you drive in traffic and you hear someone playing loud music out their car?
It would be
an actual performance.
That is Sia every morning. Every morning when he parks his car and I happen to be there. Can you remember? There's like loud music coming from the car.
Imagine an actual... Imagine
like the MCQB, but just one oak.
What is that noise? I'm on the highway. It's early in the morning. What is that terrible noise? Oh, here comes Sia on his float.
Is that legal? Could I actually do that?
It would take him 20 minutes to back into any parking lot.
But it would turn into a jaw in that parking lot. Sia would have six packs and speedos left and right.
Go-go dances. Can you imagine?
I don't want any attention. His robe would go down the steps.
Sia, you've told us 100 times you want to have birthday parties almost every year that would be major productions. It would involve dancers and singers. And
true.
They'd be televised.
But that's what I've actually always marveled at with all of these American lotteries. There you have Sally and Sue standing there with a massive check that says exactly how much they have.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's the South African mentality of always looking over your shoulder. But I'm like, girl, you're about to walk out of that building. Mm-hmm. And people, you're a walking target, essentially.
I'll tell you what, if I have or if I ever do win the lotto, you're never going to know. Not me. I'm gonna keep that shtum. I'll keep doing the work I've always done. I might occasionally buy myself something nice, but you wouldn't even know.
But just getting back to this woman. So what if the courts say, no, you bought a ticket, you're playing the game, you've got to make public appearances. Now she's got this like full-on dilemma. Okay, so basically $350 million and I've got to do this. Is it worth it? Because if you came to her with no lottery involved whatsoever and said, hi, can I give you $100 million to act rich for a day for all the people in your town? She'd go, yeah, cool, I'd do it.
Yeah.
Because she's getting paid to do something.
It's the rules. Like it says it there. Like if you play this game, you have to be over 18. Right. And you have to, if you win, we'll give you money.
I get that. What I'm interested in here is like what Ben's getting at here. How much is your privacy worth?
Yeah.
That's the real question.
Definitely $350 million US covers my privacy. You can get my privacy and I'll make you a sandwich. You can have 5 of my privacy for that.
I mean, you can even misrepresent me as
privacy.
You can misrepresent me as a human for that much money. You can say I slaughter seals.
I know you are a human, Ben.
You can say that I'm the younger brother of Lizard King. Like, you can say what you want for that much money. I don't care.
Yeah. I agree.
Say what you want with me. I'm living my life.
What would you change? Because actually, now that I think about it, I would stop working. Because I don't need a salary, clearly.
Mm.
Like the interest upon interest earning is going to sort me out. So why am I wasting my time clocking in 8 hours somewhere where I would or could rather do something different every day?
I definitely wouldn't work.
I also, now that I think about it, I'd quit immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So now if I wake up tomorrow and I decide, oh, actually, you know what? I've always wanted to study philosophy. Then that's what I'm going to do. Once that's done, it's, oh, actually, you know what? I always wanted to do this thing. Like, okay, why would I still?
So you will still have goals and you still have ambition because you know what happens with the kids of really rich people is that very often they end up purposeless and it drives them crazy. They end up like severely addicted to things and their lives go backwards and they end up being a disaster because they don't have a purpose. So you're not saying that you would give up on things that interest you.
No.
You wouldn't not have a purpose, but you would not have a job.
No, because now I don't need a job and that time actually I could use to do other things that I've always wanted to do.
My purpose
and do
would
different
be to,
things every day.
Now, I'm interested in what those things are.
I would lie down. My purpose would be to lie down for
Me too.
And traveled. I would travel just.
Travel
to,
definitely.
I'd watch travel bands I like down. In cool countries and then intermittently lie down. When I want to, I'll lie down. And when I want to travel. And I'll spend the other time deciding whether to lie down or travel.
Sounds like a great way to live life, Gord.
Ben, you'd travel. I know you'd.
I'd do exactly what I'm doing right now in my life. I would not change a single thing. I would just buy a cool house, a cool car, and I'd just do more travel. But otherwise, I'd still be me. I'd still create content. I'd still do me. Yeah. It's fun. I like it. I like being me.
This is what I think we can never fully grasp up until we are in.
He's fantasizing about floats.
I mean, between lying down and floats.
I love seeing it.
I'd hang out with you both, like all the time.
Floats out of the equation. It is the idea that you are in a position where there's no. There are no limits on what you can do.
Yeah.
You could wake up and decide.
That's exactly what Bill Cosby used to experience. There's no.
That is the beauty and the curse. Because now, of course, I'm going to employ 24 people who will never turn down my ideas. You know, I want someone to die permanently. I want to hire someone who will permanently dye their skin green and they'll feed me vegetables.
I'd be a tyrant. There'd be no.
Like... So when you now have $350 million, take tax away, what is that? Like,
yeah, she's got 265 at the end of it. I've worked it out.
Yes, yeah, like.
But you still have.
Look, the point is, I don't want us to go down the fantasy, like what you do with all this money trap, because we've been down that a number of times. Mm. I'm still curious about like what your privacy's worth.
I can have it.
And you can change.
No. But fix a number to it.
No, I'm serious.
Like how nice is it to be nobody? To not have anybody in your business. I'm talking about, you know, the kind of world where nobody knows how much is in your bank account. Nobody knows what you do for a living. Not from the point of view of mystery, but privacy. How much of that do you need? But because that's like we've discussed time already. Like we've discussed money. What would you be willing to value your privacy?
Sure, but to what extent, like, are you giving up your privacy? Like, can now the whole world read your WhatsApps anytime they like? Like, by losing your privacy, do you mean that you're like an Eminem level celebrity where you know, anytime you leave your house, people recognize you? Or does it mean that you have no right to privacy? Any conversation you have, any sex you have, any WhatsApps you send, is that now on the public record? Like, what do you mean you lose your privacy?
Yeah, I think people know things about you. You're not a tap dancer for people, though.
Yeah, but this is such a tough question for me to try and answer because I already feel like I am a nobody purely because I have my gates up so high. Like, even family members don't know certain shit about me. And sometimes I literally don't even let people in through my house. We spoke about this yesterday. So I already feel like I've got that in check where people know so little about me and deliberately so.
Yeah, I mean, fame, extreme fame. And I know, like, because I'm obviously a big Eminem fan, and I know it's a thing that he really battles with, and it's in his lyrics and whatever, and having achieved the dream comes at a price. But, like, he can still – you can't watch what he's doing in his bedroom. There's no, like, live stream from his toilet.
Okay, let's take it to extremes. Let's say you have no privacy whatsoever.
Like Big Brother vibes.
Yeah, you're like Jim Carrey in that show where –
Truman Show.
Great where movie. People can watch you, they can hear you, they can see every aspect of your life.
I wouldn't have that. I wouldn't be able to live with that.
That would be awful.
Yeah. I'm too freaky in the bedroom.
There's no amount of money you could pay me to be.
But what if it's for, because that's like saying, okay, I'll give you $100 million to be on a reality show for a year.
Never.
For a year, sure.
$100 million.
No, for sure.
No, I don't think so. I know that it sounds ridiculous.
I could behave for a year.
But at the same time, guys, I mean, if you're going to do this, it's not going to be – you can act like someone else. You can put a persona up.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, if needs be, then I would pretend to be somebody that I'm completely not for a year.
Yeah,
365
days. You know
how
hard that is?
It's an acting role. And then after that, I'm like...
$100 million.
Yeah, exactly.
No, a year is easy. You start getting into 3 years and 5 years
I'll
and 10 years. Then it's like, oh, no, can I keep it up?
$100 million.
Seriously, for $100 million, I actually might be a male dancer for
you. Yeah, I'll be anything you want.
Guys, think about $100 million, what you would do. I would probably work at a Listeriosis Poloni factory.
No, but I mean, honestly,
you can watch me do it.
Yeah, I mean, burdensome fame. I would. You can give me piles of money, and I'll give you that. Like total lack of privacy on a scale that doesn't actually really exist outside of a Big Brother TV show. I wouldn't be able to live with that.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be like seen making a poo every day.
No,
yeah.
For 100 million, even I think it's there's my level. There, okay, there you got it.
There we go. We found Ben's price. He doesn't want to be seen making a poo.
Well, he uses a squatty potty, so it's very awkward to watch.
Yeah. Well, we discovered this on Monday. Ben uses a squatty potty, which is, I think, very good for his colon.
I don't know what that is, and I don't want to. I'll Google it later.
Just listen to the show. Gorgeous, a very good show.
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll find out.
All right, coming up in a little bit, we're going to speak to Adam Broomberg and Oliver Channerin. We're going to talk about their art. They're both in South Africa at the Goodman Gallery for a very special exhibition called Bandage the Knife, Not the Wound. It's on Tuesday next week, and we're going to talk to them in a second. They've also got a solo museum exhibition at the Pompidou Center in Paris, which is called Divine Violence. And we'll talk a little bit about the work that they've done and the work that they're doing. And I think you're going to be very interested to hear the story. That's coming up in just a second or two. CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday.
Intellectually, we are superior to the blacks.
The notion that these people can be equal is not a scientific way of looking at it.
That has been proven beyond any reasonable doubt over the years.
The ideal is of a white ethno-state.
The Group Areas Act will allow for this separate development of ethnic groups.
We want a new type of society that would actually be a homeland for all white people.
There is no permanent home for even a section of the Bantu in the white area of South Africa.
This country does belong to white people.
The Republic of South Africa has been made by the white mind for the white man.
We define what America is.
If the words of President P.W. Botha, leader of South Africa's apartheid government, and Richard Spencer, current leader of white supremacist movement, the alt-right, have taught us anything, it's that there's never been a better time to learn from the mistakes of our past. Start by visiting the Apartheid Museum today.
This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, there's a blast from the past. Gord Laws is just saying he hasn't heard this song in ages, but now it's going to be in his head for the whole year. Tattoo and All About Us. Well, this morning it's all about you, and we want to introduce you, in case you haven't heard the name before, to Adam Broomberg, who is an artist who was born in Johannesburg. He's based in London now, and he's just brought to South Africa a new exhibition called Bandage the Knife, Not the Wound. Opens on Tuesday evening at the Goodman Gallery in Johannesburg. And I'm very pleased to have him in here this morning. And I have one of your works, which I just showed you, and I've had it for a couple of years now. So it's a pleasure to meet the artist behind this work. You do some controversial stuff, Adam.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, it is good. Because you have to be provocative. I mean, art isn't just a work of aesthetic beauty anymore. It could be. But it's so much more interesting when there's a theme, when there's an idea, when there's a thought, when there's a sort of iconic representation of something, which is almost like an artifact, a moment in time that is associated with mm-hmm. it. It just gives it enormous depth and relevance, which you wouldn't get from something that's just pretty.
I couldn't agree more. And I think people who work with representation are actually on the front line of politics right now. I mean, right. I was just listening to your show when I was outside the window, and you mm-hmm. were talking about face recognition technology. Yes. In fact, one of our most recent projects, we got wind of a Russian corporation that was at the avant-garde of developing the most sophisticated facial recognition technology. This was about 2 years ago. It's now been rolled out worldwide. And what they developed was a system whereby if you walk down the street, it would identify, they had little cameras, little sections of your face, And by the time you had reached the end of Tyrone Avenue or whatever it was, they would have mapped your entire face. It went in a database, which means essentially that all of our faces are now on that system. And we are all, in fact, criminals waiting to commit a crime in the future, right?
So they've got a database on all of us already.
Absolutely.
God, and there goes that privacy argument we were just having, because there isn't any. Mm. Full stop, huh?
And I think privacy is like a key part of our work and our concerns, really.
Yeah, you've done a lot. I say controversial just because it's a bucket term for a lot of the stuff that you do that is provocative, that gets people thinking. But how did all this begin? I'm curious as to how someone from Johannesburg can become an artist of international repute and with exhibitions at places like the Pompidou Center. I mean, this is no small scale thing. A lot of artists who are very talented and very capable and very and even who are much respected and admired when they start off don't necessarily reach the kind of stage that you've got to. How does that happen?
You know what? I think if you looked at this country, there's a disproportionate amount of incredibly good and successful artists have come out of this small little place. And I think it's no coincidence that we've all grown up under a terrifying system that's given us cause for concern, commitment, and a kind of thought process. So I think, like, our South African origins are, it's not coincidental, you know, and in fact, it's not working against us.
That's the crucible.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So how did it all start for you? I mean, what kind of work did you begin with? And when did you realize that this is something that you wanted to do?
I worked in Hillbrow Records. Back in the day, yeah. Chasing shoplifters down the street. But it started with a friendship with my partner in crime, Oliver Chanron, who's also of
South. I thought
South
he was coming
African.
In this morning. Yeah. He said he's not here. You're representing for
he's,
both.
He's having a lie-in.
Okay.
And it started through friendship, which is probably the best way to start anything. And then slowly, but very in an undisciplined way, turned into a kind of professional partnership. And that's it. We never planned on it. You know, it's 20 years down the line now. It's 2 decades of working together. And we still don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
What's your preferred medium? Or what was it when you started?
I think we're always primarily concerned about photography. But that's like saying we're concerned about oxygen, you know, sure. Because photography is so ubiquitous. I'm looking in this room. There are 5 cell phones,
yeah.
Mobile phones. And I think it's really interesting to look at where we are in terms of photography right now. You know, I mean, everybody is constantly documenting their own lives. We wrote in the press release for the show, 13 trillion images were produced last year. Now, if you compare that to 20 years ago when we started lugging a 5x4 Land camera, you know, with negatives, and we used to shoot, you know, schlep all the way to Russia to get into a private military zone and take 10 pictures because that's what we could afford. Now, you know, with Instagram and Facebook, we're all like generating thousands of images. And it goes back to this idea of privacy, I think, which is on the one hand, we're kind of broadcasting our lives, yeah. Right? And we think we're in control of that narrative. But in fact, and this is part of what comes up in the show we're doing at Goodman, we can see more and more we're feeding a machine, you know, because who's actually making money out of that?
Not you.
No, it's the people who are in control of the metadata, who know where those images sit, who are in control of the distribution of them. And so there's this kind of, you know, we get a little dopamine hit and we feel in control of our lives. And yet we're feeding this kind of massive, unregulated, neoliberal machine that's come out of Silicon Valley.
Well, I mean, who should we be more suspicious of? Them, because they're obviously partly responsible for this, or people like Putin who are using it for very obviously nefarious purposes. I mean, you've mentioned the Russians a couple of times since we sat down and started talking, and I am nervous about what kinds of things they're doing. And I'm nervous about the fact that we can't walk down the street anymore without some camera somewhere saying, oh, that's where he is.
Mm.
It's almost like in these spy movies, but now it's really happening.
Yeah, but we willingly taking part in the system, right? So, and I think also, you got to understand this is the biggest industry in the world, right? And it is the only one which is absolutely unregulated from a financial or political or social aspect.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ethical discussion, even amongst young students. You know, I spend a lot of time teaching young photography students, and their lives, their social lives, their kind of social interaction that happens online or in cyberspace or whatever we want to call it, it's a whole new landscape, right? It's a whole different thing to what you and I were brought up thinking and feeling it was.
And they're immersed in it every single day, and it's almost a priority over real life.
And now I wouldn't undermine the profundity of those relationships just because they're happening on that platform. Unfortunately, that platform is controlled and owned by a handful of people. So you were talking about Mark Zuckerberg earlier this morning. I mean, you know, with his very sweet smile, he said we're going to be adjusting everything in the spirit of things. 1 week later, all his customers who are outside, who are located in the EU, are conveniently shipped off to California, where they have less stringent data laws, while he keeps them in Ireland, where they have less stringent tax laws. You know, and if that is not
manipulation,
you know, and like toxic behavior, and you know, in the spirit of no good, of no kind of no civic
well
care, really.
you've got a warm reception here for any anti-Zuckerberg sentiment, because I think all of us have started to realize that he's probably public enemy number one when it comes to trying to protect any of your privacy. But I'm curious as to what you think of South Africa. You come back here often enough, but and, you know, you've got connections here in terms of where you're from and your family and all sorts of other things. But I'm curious as to how you observe us right now as opposed to how you've seen us every other time. Do you think that there's something interesting going on right now? Because we really did go through a lot in the last 8 to 10 years, which has changed many people's opinions about what South Africa was post Nelson Mandela in 1994 and all the rest of it, and where we're headed now. Do you have any preconceived notions of that, or any researched notions?
I mean, I think I don't come here enough to kind of really have a finger on the pulse, but what I do feel very strongly is that although people talk about a generation with no kind of living memory of apartheid, I think that both the trauma and the political engagement lives on in the young generation. And there's a few incidents which, you know, I don't necessarily have to quote here, but I think that people are incredibly switched on and have a sense of agency that the equivalent generation in Europe or America do not have. They don't feel entitled to have a political position. They don't feel entitled to challenge those in authority. And I think as much as the so-called kind of peaceful revolution of 94 has been a thorough disappointment, on the other hand, I think that that kind of political engagement lives on, you know, and it's, I see people who have, you know, who are fighting here in a good way.
Yeah. In other words, there's a tremendous sense of empowerment along with that agency and that entitlement you're talking about.
Correct. Yeah.
And it's long overdue.
Yeah.
It should have really been their parents' province, but here we are.
Well, they were sold down the river, weren't they?
Exactly. So let's just talk for a second about some of the things that you're interested in doing with this exhibition you've got at the Goodman. And I do want to talk about the one at the Pompidou Center too, because that's quite a, as I say, in artistic terms, that's a very big deal to be put on there. There are only a few places in the world that are more prestigious in terms of having a venue for an exhibition of your own. So here at the Goodman, what are we expecting?
We have devised a show called Bandage the Knife, Not the Wound.
Okay.
I'm not going to give away all its secrets, but just to tell you that it marks a big change in our practice. I think we've spent 20 years dealing with political issues in a very tight conceptual manner. So I think one of our last shows here, we looked at the history of Polaroid and how they colluded with the apartheid government. We looked at the history of Kodak and how inherently racist color film was until it was pointed out by Jean-Luc Godard that it was actually predicated to white skin. We've been embedded with the British military, the Israeli, we've been in Iraq, but each time it's been to kind of reveal how power functions. We've got ourselves embedded, often lying through our teeth, pretending to be journalists and not artists. And funnily enough, those in power are often more scared of artists than they are of journalists. And this show here really is a kind of moment of departure, I think. For the first time, we're looking at not other people's archives or other institutions' archives, but our own. And a lot of the works on the wall are very personal, intensely personal. We don't necessarily reveal all of the stories. And also didn't necessarily start with a very tight, conceptual, rigorous, political position, but started in a more playful, intuitive, and kind of unconscious way. So a year ago, I moved from London to Berlin, and Ollie and I shared a studio for 20 years. And almost unconsciously, we started this kind of exchange of images where Ollie would send me an image, I'd put one on top, send it back to him. So it was this game of like exquisite corpse. But what's so interesting, and we use, because we were similarly feeling a little bit kind of in a cul-de-sac, how do we feel about photography in this age of 13 trillion images, you know?
Which how do you stand out in that?
And I think our reply to that was to find those images that refuse to be deleted over the generations of hard drives, and those few images that really are meaningful to one another, and they're not necessarily the same for both of us. And then so this exchange, this kind of exchange in images and the layering of them one upon the other is kind of what informs the show.
That sounds very, very interesting. I'm curious also as to, you know, sort of the ideological take on the world as it is at the moment, because there's this dilemma, particularly on the left, between giving the state more power to make things fairer and more equal, and not trusting the state because the state has been the embodiment of this structural power relationship, which is so prejudicial to individual freedom and sovereignty.
Mm.
I mean, do you have a position on that?
Yeah, I mean, mostly through our medium. I mean, if you look at the history of photography, it is, since its inception, inherently tied to power. So, you know, the police mugshot, you know, made by Alphonse Bertillon was paid for by the police. Most early photography was paid for by governments or states sending emissaries out to photograph, you know, Palestine, which was imaged as a mostly empty land, or those images of the early West in America. So, and there was a subtext to those images, which is saying these places are devoid of people ripe for colonization, right? So I think when you look at any form of photography, it's always been tied in with power. I mean, policing, cataloging, you know, counting. And so when we spent time in Polsmoor Prison, it was very easy to get the permission of those in power. And when you walk around a prison or a psychiatric hospital and you're carrying a camera, you're immediately seen as part of the establishment, right? So it's got this toxic relationship, photography yeah. with power.
Well, how does it make you feel that your medium of choice is being utilized now, even in this day and age, at a time where we're supposed to be more free than we've ever been? And I do think we are. but that it's being utilized for identification and for advertising, and it's being used to control, in effect.
Well,
I think never before.
I think that's what drives our practice. So, for instance, this facial technology thing I was talking about, we actually got access to the company in Russia before they had rolled out this technology. We went to Russia and we reenacted a body of work made during the Weimar Republic by August Sander, who photographed everybody from the banker to the baker to the artist's wife. It was a lifelong task, right? We did it in 2 days. We got all of those characters, the banker, the radio presenter, the analyst, cast in Russia, and we got them to walk through these doors, and in 2 days they were all imaged and catalogued, and we published that as a book called Spirit is a Bone, and it was almost published just before it was rolled out as a way of warning people.
This is what's coming.
This is what's coming, right? And we're not in control of our own image, and we're not in control of our own public space. But I think this show is, like I said, marks a departure in that these images are intensely personal and private. And that's also another way of battling that, where you can hold on to something. Something's still sacred, right? Mm. That nobody can touch. And that's a beautiful feeling when you're holding that close to you. And in this case, sharing it with many, many people.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear there is still something sacred.
Mm.
Because in all of this, you tend to think that everyone's going to turn into a Kardashian and that we become devoid of that kind of sanctity.
But no, only if Silicon Valley gets their way, I think.
But you said now that these pictures are being put into the world, and we're cataloging ourselves and documenting ourselves, and you said we're doing it voluntarily. It's almost not even a powerful enough way to describe it. It's being done enthusiastically. We're very keen to make sure that you got us from all angles all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Capture us.
Yeah, I mean, we do it for self-promotion, but also the flip side is the kind of self-flagellation, right? But, I mean, we are constantly broadcasting ourselves. And I think, like I say, I'm repeating myself now, but all we're doing is providing fodder for this machine, data for this giant machine.
Who are those people who said that there was a tribe or a certain group of people who never wanted to be photographed because they believed that it stole a piece of their soul?
Well, there's always been that
rumor. Is that apocryphal?
There's that rumor that when Africa was colonized, there was people were greeted with that, with this paranoia that their soul would be captured by this kind of technology. In fact, I think what the narrative actually is that people were aware that they were being policed, catalogued, colonized, and they were resisting that in a political way. So I think that's a little sweet, little not urban but colonial anecdote that robs the politics of that resistance, you know?
Have you ever encountered anyone who won't let you have their photograph?
Many times, and really, really enjoy it when that happens.
Because it's a rare thing.
Yeah. No, and it's
like
also,
that woman who doesn't want people to know she won the lottery. Well, listen to this list of places where you've already exhibited: the Museum of Modern Art, the Tate in Britain, the Tate Liverpool, Guangzhou Biennale, which, of course, is one of the... That's the one in China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's this list goes on and on. There's the Tate Modern, the Museum of Modern Art, the Stedelijk Museum in Holland, the Victorian Albert, the Museum d'Elysée in France, the Pompidou Center, which we've just spoken about very briefly today, and now at the Goodman Gallery for everybody in South Africa to get to see Adam and Oliver and their work. So that starts on Tuesday.
It actually started last night.
Uh-huh. So this Tuesday.
This Tuesday.
Wasn't next Tuesday. So go along and see that. Adam, thanks for coming in to see us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is terrific. And if you want to see some of their work in action, you know where to go. Goodman Gallery. It's always nice to see what's happening and to keep ourselves up to date with all of this. And we will be returning tomorrow between 6 and 9. Don't forget, it's a short week. Friday's a public holiday, so lots of people are excited about that too. Now, I mentioned earlier that we had a discussion yesterday with OnePlan, and we were talking about some of the things that they know about insurance that you may not know. Important thing to take note of, according to them, they gave me some info that you need to know about before you take out any cover. You need to read, and I know everybody gets annoyed by this, but you need to read the terms and conditions about what you're about to take out in terms of cover. Remember also to pay attention to what is excluded and what your waiting periods are. Do your homework before taking out any cover. And remember that the client, that's you, has a 7-day cooling off period. This does fall as part of your rights and responsibilities as a client under the Consumer Protection Act. And if you need to know more, you can always ask the guys at OnePlan and they'll be happy to help you. Remember, you need to have your medical identification card on you. You need to have all that stuff with you or in your car so that if you're involved in something ugly, authorities know if you have medical cover or else they're going to take you to the nearest state hospital. We were discussing this just earlier. Rather be safe than sorry. Get your medical cover now. OnePlan products are easy to understand. The claims process is uncomplicated. And remember, health insurance, which is what they offer, is the lump of a sum that covers hospital care. If you're in an accident, you have an emergency that's medical in nature or operation, you will be covered. To find out more, go to oneplan.co.za or SMS the word health to 31664 and they will call you back. SMS health to 31644 for affordable health insurance from as little as 330 Rand a month. That's health to 31644. OnePlan will call you back. It's as easy as that. All right, Mubs, are you ready for the unnews?
Let's hit it.
Let's hit it. Here's the important stuff you need to know this morning before we clear out of here. And don't forget, we've got some interviews, some amazing content, some lovely stuff coming up today. Busy day Wednesday, as always. Here's the important info for the news. All right. First things first. This is a shocking story. Comic book icon Stan Lee is being sued for sexual assault. A massage therapist said he touched her inappropriately during two sessions last year. Now, Stan Lee's an old man, right? And he responded by saying it's all made up. He's a hero, not a villain. Another day, another DA debate on what to do with Patricia DeLille. Apparently, she didn't tip a car guard in Woodstock last week, something that is a criminal offense within the DA. No word yet on when a disciplinary hearing will take place, but actions are being taken behind the scenes. You can bet your bottom dollar. And finally, Maria Sharapova has lost again as she tries to reclaim her place again among the top women tennis players in the world. She says she's feeling a little flat right now and may seek medical help to address the matter. She just needs to find something that won't upset WADA too much. Just a little upper. All right. We will see you tomorrow. Coming up, an interview with Dan Nickel and Khan Morby, which we did in 2016, and if you haven't heard it before, there's an opportunity for you to catch up on that. Lots of things happening this morning. CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday, and don't forget, tomorrow is kind of a mini Friday. All right, stick to the plan for this week. Don't overdo it.
This is CliffCentral.com.